can't do without you, sugar. You know I can't do without you. Your love means as much to me.
Here's for a friend of the old Wolfman, and he wants me to play the next song for a blonde young lady in a Thunderbird. Now, my friend's name is Kurt, and he wants to talk to you out there, baby, so you meet him at Burger City, or you can phone Diamond 3132. Now, he's a friend of mine, you hear. And little girl, you better call him or the Wolfman gonna get you.
Tonight you're mine completely. Give your love so sweetly. Tonight the light of love is in your eyes. But will you love me tomorrow? Shine as a lasting treasure, or just a moment.
The world, the sound with the beat, the sound that sets you tapping your feet. Radio, the sound of year-round pleasure.
the sound of the news, rhythm and blues,
Tchaikovsky swing, whatever you choose.
Radio, the sound of year-round pleasure.
あなたは
recording, and but I can edit anything, so we can say whatever we like and we can edit out anything we don't want. Exactly. So I guess we should start from the beginning, I guess, and I have a question for you, because I read that you guys, or your family, were born in Utah. Okay, I was, you and your sisters were born in Utah?
Actually, yes. We lived there until I was about 2 years old. And I think Melody was born in Salt Lake, and Deborah and myself for sure. Peggy was born in a little town called Payson, Utah. And we moved to Kentucky and lived there for 2 years. And then we lived in Ohio. That was when I was 2 years old. And Melody, of course, that's where she learned to sing wonderful songs to the radio. She'd be singing harmony. My mom couldn't believe it. She came in the room and there she was. And so she and mom, it was just a natural thing. They started singing little duets. My mom would sing the melody and Melody would sing the harmony. And it was really awesome. I remember also Deborah at the time. She was the youngest. And when we got to Kentucky, she was about 6 months old, I think. And she, it was right around Christmas time, and she could actually hum. This, I know this sounds incredible, but she could actually hum a little da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da for Silent Night. And I remember thinking, this is so amazing, even though I was tiny. I was 2.5 years older than Deborah. And then shortly after that, by the next Christmas, she actually was asked to sing Silent Night as a solo in church. And our church building was like 30 miles. It was in Paducah. We lived in La Center, Kentucky. And so we would have all this time in the car driving back and forth from church, and we would just sing we had no radio on in the car, and we would spend that entire time singing. And I really do think that helped us develop our love for harmonies and singing that a cappella style, which actually we ultimately really perfected in the later years with singing four-part harmonies. I think they call it Barbershop and Sweet Adeline, those styles of harmonies and arrangements, which we adored.
All right. My next question would be, how were you and your sisters found by Danny Kaye, whose television show you were on?
Well, after we moved back to Utah from Kentucky and Ohio, that was a 3-year period of time, we right away were asked to perform at the Orem Farm Festival, and that was our first time that we all sang together, the four of us. And I think Deborah was just barely 4, I was 6, Peggy was 7, and Melody was 9. And that was a really amazing experience, because from that point on, we were asked to perform constantly for everything and anything, and my dad were so generous with their time and their efforts and their willingness to allow us kids to perform all over. And we were performing at a hotel up in Utah, up in Salt Lake, and there was a man who happened to be there. And he came up to us after the show and he said, "Oh, I love your singing, your three-part harmony. It's so wonderful." He said, "I would like to coach you. I'm already working with a brothers group up in Ogden, Utah." And he said, they're the Osmond Brothers. And, of course, we'd never heard of them. They were, just darling kids. Like we were, little kids, nobodies at that time in Utah. And so Val said, his name was Val Hicks, and he actually had quite an established name in the barbershop, PEBSQSA. That stands for, I won't even try to go in and say what each letter stands for, but it was encouraging four-part harmony, barbershop-style singing throughout the world. And so he started driving down to Salt Lake, and he would work with us on a regular basis, teaching us this more improved, more difficult, but awesome harmony. And we then would be booked to perform on different shows throughout the state of Utah. And we got to meet the Osmond family. We became very good friends with them and performed on quite a few barbershop shows there in Salt Lake and Bountiful, Utah, and a few different, cities throughout Utah. Well, every time we performed, people would say to my parents, "When are you going to take those girls to California? Take them to Hollywood. Get them on the Lawrence Welk show," of course, like the Lennon sisters. And so the last 2 years that we lived in Utah, that was when I was 10 and 11, or almost 12, we literally performed. I have an old calendar that my mom would always write when we were performing, and it was like every other day or night. We had a performance. You can imagine how busy we were, and that's with school and everything else. So Val Hicks, our coach, and the Osmonds coach, we all got together, the two families and our coach, and we decided we were going to make the move to California. We were going to do it. And so my father actually got a job as the building inspector in Orange County. And Val Hicks got a job as a school teacher, which he was doing in Salt Lake, at Brea Junior High School, where Peggy and I were started attending. And we moved. And at the last minute, the Osmonds decided they weren't going to move at this time. So we said, well, my dad had already stopped his job in Utah, and we had made plans, and we were moving forward. And we did. And a short time after that, our coach, vocal coach Val Hicks, was also working with a group called the Dapper Dance. And they were the group of barbershop guys who were at the Upjohn and the Dixieland Jazz stage and all over in Disneyland. And so Val would come down to work with them, and they actually got us booked there, and also the Osmonds. The Osmonds at the Dixieland stage, and I think we came up and sang the song that we performed together called These Will Be the Good Old Days 20 Years From Now. And at that performance, the scouts for Disneyland After Dark were watching the Osmond Brothers, and they wanted to put them on their film. It was a wonderful special that they did on about Disneyland, and it was called Disneyland After Dark. And on that show, when it aired, the boys came down to California and their father, and they actually stayed with us at our home in Brea. And that was really fun. We got to then go and we weren't there for the filming, but we got to go to Disneyland and sing at the Upjohn Theater with the Dapper Dans, and the Osmonds were there at the same time. And it was an amazing experience. So from that, Mr. Williams, who was Andy Williams' father, he saw the Osmond Brothers on that show, and he contacted Andy, who had this wonderful variety television show at the time, and he said, you've got to take a look at these four boys. They remind me of you and your brothers, because he sang with his three brothers as a quartet. So sure enough, they loved the Osmonds. They became maybe a year contract. I don't know. It could have been more than that. And at one of those shows, we went for the taping. And after the taping, our manager at the time, our agent at the time was Don Williams, who was Andy Williams' brother, and of course, he was the Osmond Brothers agent also. It was General Artists Association, which then became William Morris years later. Anyway, so we did. They asked us to sing with the boys, and we did. And it was that same song, These Will Be the Good Old Days 20 Years From Now. They loved it. They wanted us to be on the show as a double quartet, and we were, and it was so fun. And from that, the people from the Danny Kaye show were looking for an answer to the Osmond Brothers to be in the sit-down spot with Danny Kaye, because he had his variety show just, I think, a year or two after, or a year after Andy's. And that's how we were seen on the Andy Williams show. And the Danny Kaye people contacted our agent, and gosh, it was phenomenal. We were booked for a full season, and then the next year we were on the show again for a full season. And the third season, we only did, I think, three shows, but it was an unbelievable experience. And I can't even express my gratitude towards the Osmond Brothers for our being a double quartet and being able to be on the Andy Williams show. It all worked out to all of our benefit.
I am a closet Osmonds fan. I'm a closet Osmonds fan. I loved the Osmonds when I was a kid. That was the first concert, big concert that my mom took me to.
Oh my gosh, how about that?
I loved them so much. Yeah, and I remember seeing them on the Andy Williams show. It is very possible that I saw you guys on there too. Yeah. So your earlier records, you were a child's group. They were more kid-type songs, or as you said, kind of a barber shop quartet-type songs. But then by the early to mid-60s, you sort of moved into more of a girl group sound. You were exploring pop music.
Yes. We actually were signed by DJ Records, which at the time was a huge label. I mean, they had really big acts, including the Beatles, released, I think, two or three singles on, and I don't know if they had any albums, but they had two or three singles on DJ Tolly, actually was the label that was a subsidiary of DJ that we released. I think we had three singles on Tolly. And there were plans for an album, but unfortunately, there was a lot of hanky-panky going on with money and people skimming off the top and payola and all kinds of stuff. There was a lot of controversy surrounding the label at the time. And it was a heartbreak for us because we were actually working with Jack Nietzsche. He was coming out to our home in Canoga Park, and we were learning some really cool songs with him. This was just after two of our releases. We hadn't had the third release yet on VJ. And we would have loved to have been recorded a little differently, but there were limitations at the time. I mean, my goodness, I think it was four tracks. We went down to Hollywood. It was in the morning. We learned all four songs that we recorded that day in the morning, and we then recorded them with the orchestra, the band, whatever. It was quite a mind-boggling experience. Of course, we didn't know anything different, and you just sang at the same time as the band, and you had to do your very best. There weren't the punch-in, punch-outs like we have of these days. These days, it's hardly fair, you know, compared to what the old groups had to do. You know what I'm saying? So, but it was wonderful. And after the day was over, we finished that afternoon, and we went home having four really good songs under our belt. And they were definitely very pop girl group kind of songs for that era. And it was great. I remember Glenn Campbell was playing guitar for us. That was way before he had ever made a name as a singer-writer. And he was a studio musician. We had a lot of pretty darn famous people. David Gates arranged the one song, Puppet, I'm Your Puppet, and he played piano, keyboards on it. So, you know, it was really, when I think there was more excitement than ever in that particular era. I don't know why. I think it was just so authentic. You know what I mean?
and I loved it. It was great to be a part of that particular history.
So those songs that you were doing were chosen for you, and at that time you weren't playing your instruments. When did you end up picking up instruments, and how did each sister decide what they wanted to play?
Well, actually, Melody had started playing guitar, and we all played these little banjo ukuleles, and we were performing with them on stage. And, of course, every opportunity I could get, I would sit down behind a set of drums, and or any drummer that would be willing to teach me anything while we were on the road, I would learn. And Deborah, the youngest sister of the group, she actually had been playing, it was in the orchestra at school, and the orchestra leader, he took a stand-up, well, it was a cello. She was too big. She wanted to play the bass, the stand-up bass, and she actually was, it was so big for her little hands. And so he put bass strings on a cello, and she was able to play, it was like a stand-up bass, but it was a cello with bass strings, and she learned to play that. And, of course, we had all had piano lessons, and so we had been exposed to instruments, just not plugging them in and being rock and roll. So that was 64, I think, when we recorded all those tunes with DJ. Then it was about 65, late 65, when we, I believe that's when it was, 65, early 66, when we had been playing with this group, Peggy and myself, in Utah. Every time we'd take a little, have a period of time when we weren't on the road, and we would take that opportunity to kind of rest up in Utah, because we had so many family members there, our grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And we would go there and we would hang out with this group called the Toads. And we would, in fact, I knew how to play the drums before I ever had a set. I would set up, you know, Quaker Oats cans, and I had a pair of drumsticks. And so we just, it was just a natural thing. I knew when we started playing, I would be the drummer, and everybody knew that. They didn't question that, because that's all I did was beat around the house with this set of sticks that I had been given. And Melody, of course, had been playing. My folks bought her a gorgeous, beautiful Martin guitar, which she had become really good playing acoustic only, but nevertheless, she had a great knowledge of acoustic and classical. She started taking classical lessons as well. And then, of course, Peggy loved the piano. We always had an old, this upright, old antique piano, and when we would work out songs or chords or whatever, learning new songs, she would kind of chord for it. And then Deborah, having had that experience playing the bass in her fifth and sixth only. So by the time late 65, we had convinced our father that it was a move we needed to make. We were dying inside, wanting to be these rock and rollers. We knew we had it in us, and we just could feel it, you know, it was happening. And we performed with a group called the Knack. Actually, they weren't the Knack at the time, they were called the Inmates. And it was an affair date. And they were on the same bill, although because of our exposure
on the Danny Kaye show, we were the headliners. We had a bigger name. And because they were the inmates, they drew a lot of a younger crowd. And there we were singing our stand-up stuff, which was great and all, but it wasn't rock and roll per se. It was, you know, Good Night, My Love, and different things like that, kind of more crooning pop songs, not so much of the rock type. And these guys had just the crowd going wild. And that's really all it took for my dad to finally say, okay, you win. And believe it or not, we went home the next night or whatever our gig ended. And we went to school. We were, three of us at the time were in a professional school down in Hollywood, just because we'd bank hours, because when we'd go on tour, then we couldn't go to school. We'd have our work that we'd take with us, our homework, but those hours that were legally banked is what saved us, because we had to go 3 hours a day. I think that was the law. And so we would go down to Hollywood to the Frye Professional School. And when we came home one day that week, right after that engagement in El Central, California, I think it was. And believe it or not, there my dad had gone to Wallach's Music City, and he got every single thing, right down to the Farfisa organ with the amplifiers. He got, originally it was a Guild Epiphone, I think, guitar for Melody and a Guild bass for Deborah, and magnetone speakers for our microphones, the Shure mics, and Ludwig red metal flaked Ludwig drums for me. And I gotta tell you, it was absolutely amazing. We walked in and we were so thrilled and excited. We got on those instruments and we didn't get off for hours every single day. That was our joy. And we had performed with a fellow. His name was Candy Candido, who did lots and lots of voices for the Disney characters. And he was the ambassador in the Allentown, Pennsylvania fair during the summer. And we had become really close with he and his wife and his two daughters, and he told us about his son, Nino Candido, who was this wonderful musician and an actor. And so we immediately called Candy, and even though we could sit down immediately and play the real easy songs like Hang On Sloopy and, oh gosh, Gloria, I think, and also, I'm trying to think of some of the other tunes. They only had like a 3-chord progression in it, you know, so it was Louie Louie, that was it. And we sat right down and we could play those. They weren't great, but we were on our way, I'm not kidding you. It was remarkable how quickly we took to those instruments. And, of course, we had the singing thing down because we had sung harmonies forever. And it just took developing and working with this guy who would come to our house. His name, like I said, was Nino Candido. And I just remember him staying there for hours. And ironically enough, at the time, we were living in this great big old Spanish hacienda, kind of almost a mansion. It had two verandas, and it was in, I think it was Arleta or San Fernando, and it was the Osmond brothers' home. Their family had gone on tour for 6 or 7 months over to Switzerland or Sweden, where they were really big stars over there, and we had purchased a home that fell through, and we basically were out. We didn't know where we were going to go. And they said, hey, we're going to be out of town for all those months. Why don't you move into our house? So they moved their stuff into their great big huge music room way back. It was a huge property, about an acre. And there was a wonderful big music room, which we had worked out in many times, dancing and singing and everything when we would go over to hang out with the Osmond brothers. Their dad didn't let them date, and so when he felt like they needed social interaction, he would call my dad and say, hey, why don't you come on over, bring the family, let the girls get together with the boys, and we'd eat dinner, we'd hang out, we'd sing together, we'd dance, we'd show them our new act, and then show us their new act. And it was just a great relationship, so we were very familiar with the home long before we then moved into the house. But that's where we set our instruments up in the living room, and we just played day in and day out. It was an awesome period of time.
And was that after you recorded Bread and Butter? Were you playing your instruments on Bread and Butter?
Yes. We recorded Bread and Butter after VJ went down. Our last release, I believe, was on VJ Records, if I recall, was like November of 64. And then shortly after that release, everything fizzled out. The record label went down. They took out Chapter 11 or whatever. And we then met this fellow, and I don't even remember how we met him at this point, but his name was Lynn Bryson. He was a DJ, and he was a songwriter. He actually wrote some really cool songs. We liked his music. We had so many people bringing their music to us, and we didn't really like it. And it was frustrating because we were starting to write our own music, and yet we were constantly inundated with everybody else's music, and we were never able to do our own, especially at that time anyway. And so we liked his music. He came to us and he wanted to cut four sides. My dad put up the money. We created our own record label and publishing company and decided we were going to distribute our own records because we were so disillusioned with VJ and the poor job that they had done for us. And we knew that we were getting airplay through touring all over the place. We'd go to the little radio stations, and at that time, you know, you go in, and if they liked you, they'd play your records. It wasn't like it was later in the 60s when the top 40 stations came in, and they were all controlled by one guy, you know, Bill Drake, I believe his name was. And so because of that, we were able to get airplay, so we thought, hey, we're going on tour again. We had this wonderful tour all lined up, and we recorded right before we went out on the road. In fact, we performed a couple of those songs on stage, and afterwards we had lots of people. We had records with us, and we actually sold them way before they were doing all that merchandising. We were selling our records after the fair dates. The big grandstand shows were really a big deal at the time. And all the top artists would like to get booked on those shows. So, and those records were recorded somewhere between, I think they were recorded in April of, I don't know for sure. April of 65, I think, or possibly March of 65, somewhere around in that time frame, because we had them ready to to go when we went on that tour during the summer of 65.
And then between 65 and 69, you guys didn't put out any records?
Well, actually, we did. We recorded. We recorded with some of the very, very best, and it was very, very disappointing. While we were on tour with the Righteous Brothers, we actually recorded, and we don't have any of those things. We had some original tunes we performed with them, and some fellas in, I believe it was Hartford, Connecticut, I'm pretty sure, and I don't even remember their names, because my dad, you know, dealt with them, and we really didn't. And we didn't even get a copy of them. We went in when we got home from that particular tour, and we did go in and recorded two original tunes, and we recorded Walk On By, which was our own version, which we then had the same arrangement that we vocally, that we did, and then Ralph Shearer, because that year we went on two very long tours, one with the Righteous Brothers. We just got back from that, and we went out on a three-month tour with Robert Goulet, and we did the one original tune that we had recorded, a tune that Melody wrote called Only You, and we also performed Walk On By. And prior to leaving on that tour, we had cut the tracks, and we didn't have time. We had already learned their vocals, and they were wonderful. It was a great arrangement, and we were going to try and get a record release of Going Out of My Head. And it was really interesting because we were so excited, and we did perform that in that on that three-month tour with Robert Goulet. And our dear friend, Jimmy Pike, who was one of the Lettermen, drove us to the airport when we were leaving to go on the road with Robert Goulet. And it was so funny because we told him, he said, so great, so, you know, good luck and everything. And we said, yeah, we can't wait to get back. We're going to cut Going Out of My Head, right? And it was unbelievable. And I'm so happy we said it, because they actually, by the time, while we're still at the end of our three-month tour, what do you think we hear on the radio? The Lettermen, Going Out of My Head and Can't Take My Eyes Off From You. And it was a smash hit. So I'm happy we influenced him, and they were able to get a hit on it. But we were a little annoyed at first. It didn't last long, though. But it was a great song, and it was time for it to come back.
So you were playing kind of pop music then, but in the later 60s, you guys released some kind of harder rock records, more rock and roll. Well, you had Blackbird, that was the Beatles cover, but then you did your version of Gonna Have a Good Time and the great song Mean It. And how did you guys get into the harder rock and roll stuff?
Well, you know, we had always been doing it. In fact, we started out when we were working with Nina Candido. Most all of the tunes we were doing were like 99 and a Half by Wilson Pickett, and a lot of really good Baby Please Don't Go, and This Will Be the Last Time, and Don't Play With Me Because You're Playing With Fire. I mean, we did a lot of rock and roll tunes at that time. And Deborah, who was the youngest, was actually with 99 and a Half. She could sound just like Wilson Pickett, and that scream that he would do, she just
She was amazing. And we don't know where she found that, but she had the soul as a little kid way back in Utah. She was the only one that could do, you know, Tarzan and his, how he'd do that call. And she would do that, and it was so amazing. And I think that it just developed something in her vocal cords that made it possible when we switched over to rock and roll, that she was able to just do all that stuff. And of course, it was awesome. And we were able to make that big time transition once we just decided that's it. We were, you know, at a fair gate, and this was in 66, September of 66, and we were actually playing the grandstand show, and at the time, our little siblings would come on stage with us, and we'd always close the show with about 3 rock and roll tunes. And, you know, that was cool. Melody wrote this song. It was called Loneliness, I think, but it was a freak-out song. It was a psychedelic, and I don't know how she did it, because she was certainly not into psychedelics at the time at all. But everybody loved it when we performed at Disneyland. This was years after the Osmonds performance. But that was one of the most requested songs that we played. So we were branching out and becoming more and more and trying to drop the Clinger sisters and just be the Clingers. And of course, when we met Michael Lloyd, we were very unhappy. We were signed with Best Production Company, and we were so excited about that. It was a brand new record. We had already recorded with Kurt Texas, who was one of the greats, and that was in 66, I think. And then in
HL Green Variety Department Store at 10th and Market Streets in downtown Philadelphia. And to celebrate, Wellington is offering these fantastic tape specials. All Elvis Presley golden hits. And from Elvis in Memphis, this is the tape with the twin smash hits Any Day Now and In the Ghetto. Henry Mancini's Warm Shade of Ivory with the theme from Romeo and Juliet. All Tom Jones and Mongo Santa Maria tapes. All Ventures including Hawaii 5-0. All Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. Only $4.82 for any of these great 8-track stereo tape cartridges. Come on over to the new Wellington Center at 10th and Market at HL Green and get in on these great special offers.
Other Wellington centers at City Line Avenue, 69th Street, Route 13 in the Levittown Bristol area, Route 45 in Woodbury, opposite McDonald's, Chester's Edgemont Avenue in Brookhaven, open 6 nights a week.
Bird stands in the corner with the barrel so straight. I looked out the window and over the gate. The big fat rabbits are jumping in the grass. Wait till they hear my old shotgun blast. Shotgun boogie, I done saw your track. Look out, Mr. Rabbit, when I cock my hammer back. Well, over on the ridge is a scaly bark. Hickory nuts are big, you can see them in the dark. The big fat squirrels, they scratch and they fight. I'll be on that ridge before daylight with the shotgun boogie. All I need is one shot. Look out, bushy tail, tonight you'll be in the pot. Well, Well, I met a pretty gal, she was tall and thin. I asked her what she had, she said a Fox 410. I looked her up and down, said, boy, this is love. So we headed for the brush to shoot a big fat dove. Shotgun boogie, boy, the feathers flew. Look out, Mr. Dove, when she draws a bead on you. I sat down on a log, took her on my lap. She said, wait a minute, bud, you got to see my pap. He's got a 16-gauge choked down like a rifle. He don't like a man that's gonna trifle. Shotgun boogie draws a bead so fine. Look out, big boy, he's loaded all the time. Called on her pap like a gentleman oughter. He said, no brush hunter's gonna get my daughter. He cocked back the hammer right on the spot. When the gun went off, I outrun the shot. Shotgun boogie, I wanted wedding bells. I'll be back, little gal, when your pappy runs out of shells.
Yeah. I love you, baby. Baby, please don't go.
Palisades has the fun. Come on over. Shows and dancing are free, so's the parking, so gee. Come on over. Palisades from coast to coast, where a dime buys the most. Palisades amusement park swings all day and after dark. Ride the coaster, get cool in the waves, in the pool you'll have fun. So come on over.
Oh, most girls call their man daddy, but that's antique to me. I found me a new name, and it fits him to a T. Mr. Fine is what I call my man. Ever since our love began, he's a man from head to toe. Please believe me, I sure know Mr. Fine, as sharp as he can be, tailor made from A to Z. To my heart he holds a key, with his personality I can say he's an angel. He has that canine streak, the secret curse of every man that makes up their physique. But Mr. Fine possesses such technique, any girl is bound to get weak. It's a thrill to know he's mine, the one and only Mr. Fine. I can't say he's an angel, he has that canine streak, the secret curse of every man that makes up their physique. But Mr. Fine possesses such technique, any girl is bound to get weak. It's a thrill to know he's mine, the one and only Mr. Fine.
Secret Ceremony doesn't open until Wednesday, but already the advance word is that her performance is really something else. People are saying that her spine-chilling role is sure to be the most talked about of the year and probably will get her an Academy Award nomination. The talk has it that Mia Farrow is more haunted than in Rosemary's Baby, and that's really haunted. Along with Mia, Secret Ceremony stars Elizabeth Taylor and Robert Mitchum. You remember, he's the one that went naked to the party with ketchup and said he was a hamburger? Together, this dynamic trio make the strangest things happen in Secret Ceremony. As a matter of fact, they say it's the strangest strange that has ever been done. Well, we know that's a lie. Don't miss Mia Farrow's newest and greatest Secret Ceremony.
This is a message from the inner space of the great beyond within the pulsating reality of the flight reaction. You are now listening to the Fringe Factory radio show on
Show. You are listening to the Fringe Factory Radio Show on WFMU Rock and Soul Ichiban. I'm Vicky V. I hope everyone had a great holiday weekend. Happy holidays, everybody. Wow, 2017 is almost over. I can't believe it. Can you believe it? We made it to 2018. Can't believe I'm saying that. Not that I made it, but that the year is now about to be 2018. And guess what? It's time for the Fringe and Faves of 2017. Every year I record a Fringe and Faves show, which is the best new releases that I feel are the best songs that I played over the last year. And we started out with the Schizophonics, easily on everybody's number one album, number one song list. I'm sure it's on a bunch of them for 2017. That was In Mono. It was off of their album Land of the Living, which came out on Sympathy for the Record Industry. Schizophonics are from San Diego, tearing it up all over the place, all over Europe, all over the United States. And that song was also released as a single. I'll probably be playing another one of those tracks off of that LP over the next two shows. So this is part one. We're going to do a part two next week. I'm going to play a little bit of a long set. If you're impatient and you want to know what the song is, head on over to wfmu.org/playlist/FY. You can follow along with the live playlist. Otherwise, enjoy the show. The Routes, another one of my favorite garage bands out of Japan. They had two albums come out in 2017. Both are easy contenders for the best albums of the year. So let's hear something from their last release, which came out in November. The album was called Dirty Needles and Pins, came out on Greenway Records. This song is called You'll See.